after it. For Saturday, November 2nd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, a former State Department official on the global challenges that await the next president, no matter who wins.
What I'm proposing is to tackle global issues through much wider global partnerships and a willingness to step back to let others step forward.
And it takes a lot to make a stew, especially with me and you.
It is a joke of a sitcom intro with people looking and smiling at the camera, and then the joke is it doesn't stop.
A look back at the viral sensation Too Many Cooks, that story and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. With less than 3 days to go before Election Day, former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris are barnstorming key southern states in a razor-thin race for the White House. We begin with NPR's Asma Khalid covering the Harris campaign in Atlanta, Georgia.
At a rally in Atlanta, Harris rolled through her plans to lower costs and tried to crystallize the contrast with her opponent as she made a final pitch. Harris is also rallying voters in Charlotte, and Trump is in North Carolina as well today, holding two separate rallies in the state. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Former President Trump's campaign schedule includes North Carolina stops every day through Monday. This afternoon, outside of Charlotte, Trump pitched his candidacy to suburban women. This as women have put in a strong showing among early voters. NPR's Sarah McCammon has the latest.
Trump spent several minutes making a pitch to suburban women who tend to be swing voters.
I will protect our women. I'm going to protect our women. I got into so much trouble. You saw that. I said, we will protect, because I keep hearing, I think the women love me. I do.
Trump later referred to Vice President Harris as a, quote, weak and foolish woman. Harris and her allies have been working to win over suburban women who previously voted for Trump. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Gastonia, North Carolina.
Trump's campaign schedule today also includes a stop in Salem, Virginia. In the Middle East, Iran's supreme leader is threatening a, quote, crushing response to Israel's attacks last weekend that took out some of the country's air defense systems. NPR's Arzu Rezvani reports from Beirut.
In a video released by Iranian state media, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei directed his threat to Israel and the United States. He did not elaborate on when Iran would strike back or how the U.S. would be included, but the U.S. military does operate several bases throughout the Middle East that have come under attack before by Iran-backed militias in the region. Khamenei's comments echo what other Iranian officials have said in recent days. The deputy commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, Ali Fadavi, said in an interview earlier this week that a response is definite, adding that Iran could destroy all that Israel possesses in, quote, one operation. Israel's October 26th attack took out several of Iran's air defense systems, as well as storage and production sites of ballistic missiles and drones. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News, Beirut.
This is NPR News in Washington. More than 200 people have died, and it's not clear how many people are missing, after devastating rain left a path of destruction in Spain's eastern province of Valencia. Day after, satellite images released by NASA Earth Observatory show parts of the province submerged in floodwaters and a river channel and coastal wetlands clogged with sediment. This was one of the deadliest weather events in modern Spanish history. Researchers have found the oldest tadpole fossil to date. NPR's Jessica Young reports on how this fossil shines new light on the evolutionary history of frogs.
Researchers have discovered a tadpole fossil that is 161 million years old, which is 20 million years earlier than scientists previously knew of. The tadpole stage lasts only a few months, and the tadpole body is delicate. And yet, this fossil is in great shape. Seeing it for the first time amazed researcher Mariana Chulivar.
I said, okay, this is the best tadpole ever, because up to now, there wasn't any other fossil tadpole with the gill skeleton preserved.
She says this discovery suggests that Metamorphosis in frogs is probably a successful survival strategy, which may be why it has lasted for so many millions of years. The paper is published in the journal Nature. Jessica Young, NPR News.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams issued a drought watch today, urging conservation. After much of the nation experienced an unusually dry October, the city uses an average of 1.1 billion gallons of water a day. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. A flood watch has been issued for parts of our listening area. It's 56 with thunderstorms. Wind is from the north. Tonight, thunderstorms with a low in the upper 50s. Wind will be from the southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Then tomorrow, a few showers with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night, a few showers with a low in the upper 50s. It's 56 with thunderstorms. Stay tuned for more KPR weather.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. 3 days, just 3 days to go until voting wraps up in this presidential election. And both candidates are on the ground today in swing states making their final pitches to voters.
All right, Atlanta. Are we ready to do this? Are we ready to vote?
Hello, North Carolina. This is going to happen. I predict, let's make a prediction. This will happen on Tuesday, I think, right? This will happen on Tuesday.
We are down to the wire in the presidential race, and polling across the board has nearly every swing state in a statistical tie, meaning the election may come down to a couple thousand votes. Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign is exuding confidence, as is former President Donald Trump's. It could go either way. But if Trump loses, like he did in 2020, he is ready to sell a story that he has been spinning for months.
Because they cheat. That's the only way we're going to lose, because they cheat. They cheat like hell.
And a lot of these illegal immigrants coming in, they're trying to get them to vote.
They are a threat to democracy. The Democrats are a threat to democracy. That's the real threat.
No matter who wins, in the coming days, we are going to hear a lot more from Donald Trump and his allies about the results. And if history is any guide, we can expect a mix of misleading information, rumors, and outright lies. To talk more about it, somebody who's been covering it all for years, NPR voting correspondent Miles Parks. Hey, Miles.
Hey, Scott.
Let us start with what seems to be the most common talking point on the right when it comes to the election. Let's hear it.
A lot of these illegal immigrants coming in, they're trying to get them to vote.
Miles, we have talked about this before, but we need to talk about it again because we keep hearing it. What are the facts? Not the framing, the facts when it comes to non-citizen voting.
Every single study has found it to be incredibly rare. A recent audit of Georgia's voter rolls, for instance, found 20 confirmed non-citizens out of more than 8 million voters. That being said, Scott, it does occasionally happen. People do occasionally slip through the cracks, whether intentionally or by accident.
Mm-hmm.
A person was recently arrested, for instance, in Michigan for being a non-citizen and voting. But that's the thing, and that's what election officials always go back to, is that there is a powerful deterrent here. If you are a non-citizen and you vote, that is illegal. And if you are arrested, that can risk your path to citizenship, which seems like act like a pretty powerful deterrent.
Consequences, serious consequences.
Yeah.
Still, a lot of conservative commentators and Republican lawmakers are echoing this narrative.
There's a number of states that are not requiring proof of citizenship when illegals or non-citizens register to vote. We know that's happening.
That is the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, speaking to Face the Nation. Miles, what's the reality here?
It's a little bit complicated because Johnson is right. Federal law prohibits most states from requiring proof of citizenship to vote. That being said, it's not like states have no idea who's on their voter rolls. The vast majority of people register to vote using either a driver's license or a social security number. These are agencies that do have access to citizenship data. So government officials have the ability to check the citizenship for most of the people on their voter rolls. And if they have a reason to believe that one of these people has cast a ballot illegally, they can refer that person to prosecution. That's the other important part here. Elections have records. There are ways to find this stuff out.
But still, when it comes to a widespread, systemic, organized plan to do this, there's just no evidence of that. We have not seen that in the past.
It's never been found, right.
Why then does this narrative of non-citizen voting, this false narrative,
help Trump's broader false claims about election integrity?
I think the sense from election officials I've talked to is that the election narratives of 2020 were starting to get a little bit stale. And so when you look ahead at 2024, what is the major political point on the right now? It is immigration. And so what experts see is basically a marrying of these two narratives. Mm-hmm. You've got an issue that is very politically salient, and you've got Trump trying to kind of activate people on that. The other thing I'll note in terms of why this is a successful election conspiracy theory is, like I mentioned, it does happen occasionally. Every election cycle, you'll see this, a few people get arrested for this. And so it's much harder to debunk a narrative like that that actually has a little bit of truth to it, as opposed to voting machines are being controlled by a satellite or something.
Yeah. Let's talk about a different narrative that we've been hearing a lot of lately. This is this idea of cheating.
There is, I think, some amount of cheating that takes place. It's hard because when you have mail-in ballots and no sort of proof of citizenship, it becomes almost impossible to prove cheating is the issue.
So that's Elon Musk, billionaire Trump supporter, who has pushed a lot of these baseless theories, especially on his social media platform, X, which used to be known as Twitter. What do you make of that? This is happening, but it's impossible to prove.
I mean, it just conveniently forgets that every time somebody votes, there is a record associated with that vote, right? That is what voter registration literally is. And so I would just urge people to go listen to what Republican election officials have consistently said, which is that voting by mail, yes, is marginally more vulnerable to fraud. But again, there has never been evidence that this is at a wide scale. When it does happen, usually at the hyper-local level, it gets found out.
Even as Trump tries to win Pennsylvania, which everybody sees is almost certainly the most important state on the electoral map, he is posting things like this just the other day on Truth Social. This is from Trump. Pennsylvania is cheating and getting caught at large-scale levels rarely seen before. Report cheating to authorities. Law enforcement must act now. Any sense what rhetoric like this, before the election is finished, before the results are in, any sense what he may do if he does lose Pennsylvania, if he does lose the presidential election?
I think there's full expectation that if he loses Pennsylvania, that the idea will be that the vote was rigged. I mean, even for 4 years, there have been calls from election officials from both parties for Pennsylvania to change how they count votes. There are rules in place that make it just take a lot longer to count mail ballots than they do to count in-person votes because they can't start until Election Day. What we are going to see almost certainly is that after the election, mail ballots, which are going to be largely Democratic votes at this point, are going to take longer to count than Republican votes. And so you can kind of see the writing on the wall of how Trump has messaged in situations like this before.
Let's talk about one more thing here. We've been talking about the political rhetoric, but a lot of the stuff that really matters in terms of the election administration and vote counting is what happens in the courts. And we've already seen a lot of lawsuits in motion. What are they targeting and what are the goals?
So the RNC and the Trump campaign say that this is really just about maintaining safeguards for the election and making sure that, quote, only legal votes are counted. But we're seeing lawsuits about all sorts of things. In some states, targeting entire voter rolls, saying states aren't doing enough to clean them. In other places, you know, targeting very specific aspects of elections, like the way people turn in their mail ballots and whether specific mail ballots should be counted. I think that part of this is not abnormal. You always see kind of election fights in the courtroom leading up to and then after Election Day. What's interesting this cycle, when you talk to election experts, it seems like the Trump campaign and Republicans more broadly are kind of already setting the stage for things, kind of giving breadcrumbs to issues that they might bring up to try to challenge the election results should Trump lose after the election.
That's NPR voting correspondent Miles Parks. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Russian dissidents who were released in a prisoner swap say they will soon hold a rally in Germany. They want to see Western countries remain united against Russia's war in Ukraine. And they want to show that their voices remain relevant even in exile. NPR's Michelle Kellerman met a couple of them in Washington.
My name is Ilya Yashin. I spent in prison for 25 months.
My name is Vladimir Karamurza, and it was 2 years, 3 months.
These are two of the Russian opposition figures who were traded in August for Russian spies and criminals in the largest prisoner swap in the post-Cold War era. Ilya Yashin did not want to be part of it.
That's true. I didn't want to be exchanged, because Russia is my home, and I do not believe that we can change Russia from outside. We can change it from only from inside.
But he says he's doing his best in exile now, planning a rally in Berlin November 17th to protest Russia's war against Ukraine.
We would like to make a strong anti-war movement And we would like to send message to our people in Russia. We're together and we have solidarity. And we would like to ask our people in Russia, do not give up and stay strong.
But Russian dissidents lost a key unifying figure this year, Alexei Navalny, who died in a Russian penal colony. Vladimir Karamurza says this is no time for opposition figures to bicker or debate each other. He says he's taking a page from Soviet dissident Vladimir Bukovsky, who was expelled in 1976 after 12 years in prisons and psychiatric wards.
He said that nobody will ever again be able to divide us into different political camps, a left-wing camp or a right-wing camp, because we were all together in the same concentration camp.
Karamurza says prison has a way of setting your priorities straight.
We have one common opponent, one common enemy. That is the murderer and the usurper who's sitting in the Kremlin, who for 25 years has been attacking and violating the most basic rights and freedoms of the Russian people, who has been attacking and invading other countries. And so whatever differences we might have among ourselves, they just completely pale in comparison to our common struggle against this dictatorship.
Ilya Yashin says when he was in prison, he tried to talk other inmates out of signing contracts to join President Vladimir Putin's war against Ukraine. Now he's meeting with world leaders, making this argument.
If you would like to help the Russian democratic movement, you should save Ukraine from Mr. Putin, from Putin's aggression. Because, first of all, if you think that Putin will stop in Ukraine, he won't.
Karamurza says the West also needs to continue to reach out to Russians who want a different future.
One thing we know from the modern history of Russia is that major political changes in our country happen like this, the snap of a finger. Both the Tsarist regime at the beginning of the 20th century and the communist regime at the end of the 20th century collapsed in 3 days, literally speaking, and nobody saw it coming. This is exactly how change is going to come to Russia next time. And it is crucial that next time we get it right.
He says this was something that came up when he spoke with President Biden soon after the prisoner swap.
At one point, he turned to me and said, how do you see Russia in 10 years? And I said, thank you, Mr. President. We need more questions like this from world statesmen because people are too focused on what's happening here and now. We need to think ahead. We need to think to the future because change will come to Russia and we have to be ready for it.
Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Saturday afternoon. Support for All Things Considered comes from Iniquitorium, Andrew Sherwood, Ph.D., Jungian analyst. C.G. Jung suggested the dreams are intentional messages from the unconscious that, when interpreted correctly, provide balance and guidance in life. More at workingwithdreams.com. And the Raven Bookstore, hosting local memoirist Louise Krug as she shares her book, How to Explain, on Thursday at 7 p.m. More at ravenbookstore.com/events. Tonight in Northeast and East Central Kansas, 80% chance of showers and thunderstorms, a low of 58%. 90% chance of showers for Sunday. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. With less than 3 days to go before Election Day, former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris are barnstorming key southern states in a razor-thin race for the White House. Harris today encouraged Georgia voters to cast their ballots early. North Carolina is also on her itinerary. Trump's campaign schedule includes North Carolina stops every day through Monday. This afternoon, outside of Charlotte, Trump pitched his candidacy to suburban women, as women have put in a strong showing among early voters. Iran's supreme leader is threatening a, quote, crushing response to Israel's attacks last weekend that took out some of the country's air defense systems. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/from Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Regardless of who wins this week's election, or next week's rather, a new presidential administration will enter the White House next year. And it will have many foreign policy challenges to address: wars in the Middle East, Europe and Africa, mass migration, and climate change. The next president will also inherit a changing world order, one in which the U.S. will play less of a leading role. One former State Department official says he or she will need to adapt, and quickly. Anne-Marie Slaughter is the former director of policy planning in the U.S. State Department. She recently wrote about this in Foreign Affairs in a piece called How America Can Succeed in a Multi-Aligned World. Slaughter argues the next president needs to move away from a statist approach, where U.S. diplomacy focuses on other nation states, and to really tackle global problems, U.S. diplomacy needs to also include different types of global actors.
What we're talking about are global corporations, global civic organizations. If you think about the humanitarian organizations from CARE to Mercy Corps to Doctors Without Borders, you can't really imagine a global crisis without them.
Yeah.
But also scientists, universities, and indeed faith groups. And those are global actors, but they are not states. And that's what I'm talking about, is that it's not that we give up on states, obviously. States are still very important, but the global stage has many other very important, powerful actors in addition to states.
What's changed about the world to make these organizations so much more important?
That's a great question. I think in many ways, the world has gotten smaller, in the sense that even in the 90s, after the Cold War, the same forces that brought us globalization of corporations, where suddenly corporations could be global entities, not just having national subsidiaries, which had been around for a long time, but global supply chains, mm-hmm. and instant global communication. And so in many ways, it's the same. Those forces of globalization, which we saw with corporations, we've seen with many other actors, and we increasingly have global problems.
You're arguing that the next president needs to, along with their administration, really engage with these non-state actors more, these organizations more. You make a point that you think the Harris administration would be much more likely to do that than another Trump administration. Why do you think that?
Former President Trump has worked with corporations globally, but his administration was focused on countries, on other governments, and only a few other governments at that, not a true focus on all the 193 nations or even 100 of them. I think a President Harris or Vice President Harris is very aware that there are multiple categories of problems. There are the geopolitical problems, where we've got Russia and China and Iran and North Korea. These are the kinds of traditional, what we call geopolitical threats. She knows how important those are, but she also knows, and this is something that was really a historic move by the Biden administration, that these problems of climate change and infectious disease and food and water security and terrorism and migration, those global problems, problems without passports that don't stop at borders, those problems are just as important as those traditional threats from other nations. Mm-hmm. And when you need to tackle those problems, you've got to have the private sector, the civic sector, the educational and the scientific sector alongside you. And I think that's a framework that she's quite comfortable with.
It's been more of a domestic policy election than a foreign policy election. But, you know, the big foreign policy questions have revolved around the ongoing war in Ukraine, the ongoing war in Gaza and now Lebanon and with Israel. There's been conversation about China as well.
setting those big three things aside, which I realize is setting a lot aside, what to you is the biggest area where we would see a wildly different policy difference between a Harris administration and a Trump administration when you're looking around the globe at these big issues and what the stakes of the election are?
Oh, unquestionably on climate change.
Yeah.
Trump will pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement again, but more importantly, he will not pursue efforts to fund emissions reductions, mitigation, adaptation. The head of the CIA, Bill Burns, says climate change is the number one existential threat. Existential meaning to our existence. And that is certainly something a Harris administration would continue. And it's a great example of a place where you need really global partnerships. The U.S., though, would be still a very active player. But under a Trump administration, it would no longer be at the federal level.
I want to ask you lastly a kind of a purposely oversimplified question. So stick with me on the question. But you're framing the world as one where the U.S. just plays a less central role in world affairs than it did before. One of your quotes is, Washington does not need to lead every initiative to facilitate the change it wants to see in the world. What is the difference between that point of view and the America First isolationism that you have seen from Trump and especially his running mate, Senator J.D. Vance, about how they talk about America's role in the world and the choices the next administration would make?
I think I'm talking about leading in a different way, because I say, yes, we don't have to lead all the time to see the change we want in the world. We can seed it instead. So part of what I'm talking about there is enabling these global partnerships of governments, often governments of quite small nations, corporations, of scientists, of civic groups, and that if you seed and support those partnerships, they will get the work done, particularly if they adopt very specific missions. The difference with the America First view is that leadership itself is a burden, and we should simply shuck that burden. I think many people who take that view might well see the kind of global partnerships I'm talking about as fine, because it's not the federal government leading them.
Mm-hmm.
But the impulse is very different. The impulse is the U.S. should just retreat from the world, whereas what I'm proposing is to tackle global issues through much wider global partnerships and a lighter hand and a willingness sometimes to step back to let others step forward.
It's Anne Marie Slaughter, the CEO of New America, a think tank in Washington, as well as a former State Department official. You can read her essay, How America Can Succeed in a Multi-Aligned World in Foreign Affairs. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.
More than $10 billion in political advertising has been spent across all of 2024's races. But two men with zero ties to any current political campaign came up with a plan to target what might be the last untouched advertising market in politics, pornographic websites. NPR political correspondent Susan Davis reports.
Earlier this year, Wally Nowinski and his buddy Matt Curry were talking about what they could do to defeat Donald Trump in the presidential election.
I'm in California. I could, like, drive to Nevada and knock on doors. It seems like that. I'm not going to reach 5 million people that way.
The two friends work in tech, and Nowinski was particularly interested in what he called, quote, subprime ad markets, a.k.a. porn sites. Actual political candidates and their allies do not advertise there because they don't want to associate their brands with that kind of content.
But then I was like, these ads are, like, real cheap, and it's, like, weirdly relevant to this campaign.
The relevance they saw was a market they believe can reach one of the key demographics in 2024.
There's 3 million non-college white men across the blue wall states. Like, that's a lot. That's a lot of people. and they're probably breaking for Trump, like, 65-70%. You only need to make a very few of them change their mind to possibly make an impact on the election.
So they did what virtually no regular voters do. They formed a political action committee and raised a modest $100,000. About $25,000 has been spent just in the last weeks of October, when inconsistent voters generally decide whether to vote or not.
We started advertising like a little over a week ago. Our videos will have been played over 5 million times in the swing states.
The ads are simple. A 5-second static image the viewer must see before they can hit skip to get to what they're there to watch. The image has ominous music and features things like a woman in lingerie with this message: Trump's Project 2025 will ban porn. Enjoy while you can. Their goal here is also simple: convince some of these Trump-supporting, porn-watching white guys to sit out the election. Steve Kaplan is a professor at the University of Southern California, and he's teaching a class this semester on political advertising.
While this is certainly a different sort of approach, it's not unusual, and it's smart in some ways, you know, in a lot of ways. It's smart to go where your audience is.
To be clear, Trump has not endorsed a pornography ban, and his campaign has repeatedly distanced itself from the conservative blueprint Project 2025, although it was crafted by Trump allies, and it does call for all pornography to be outlawed. Here's Kaplan again.
I think it's a fascinating example of how far campaign advertising, targeting, and hyper-targeting has evolved.
With $75,000 in the bank to spend by Election Day, Nowinski estimates their swing state ad campaign could hit 20 million views. That, he says, sure beats knocking doors. Susan Davis, NPR News, Washington.
As fire season begins to wrap up in much of the western U.S., women who fight fires for the U.S. Forest Service are looking ahead. Women only make up 13% of the service's fire positions, and there's a new effort to help them stay in their careers and balance family life. Montana Public Radio's Alice Julin has more.
Sarah King is a first-time mom in Bozeman, Montana, whose infant daughter is napping nearby as she looks down at her hands, reminiscing about how they used to look.
Half my fingers are, like, taped up, you know, from just, like, blisters, you know, and just cuts and things like that, you know. But and then it would just be, like, black.
Black from ash. King has been a wildland firefighter since graduating college.
For me and for a lot of firefighters, it's just like this like sense of pride.
King loved traveling across the country to fight fires at a moment's notice, carrying a 50-plus pound pack miles into the backcountry, or deftly wielding a chainsaw to cut down trees. Then she got pregnant and had to rethink things.
Oh my gosh, what is my career trajectory now? And we were planning to get pregnant, but I don't think that that thought process really sank in until I had like gone on that fire and then found out I was pregnant.
She transferred to a job preventing fires. King's glad to still be working for the U.S. Forest Service, but taking a break to give birth and then a more office-oriented job has consequences, like having required firefighting qualifications lapse. For King, that means she'll be starting from ground zero when she's ready to go back on fire assignments.
I really miss that aspect of my job, you know, and just balancing like life and a career and a kid and also just like desires. It really takes a toll on your mental health, you know, then I'm learning that the hard way.
King wants help trying to achieve that balance. Jamie Toland has navigated being a woman in this male-dominated field for close to 30 years.
Through my career, I always felt like I had to prove myself, like prove that I could be there and keep up and do the job. So there still is a lot of that, like the good old boy network.
Toland always wanted to fight fire, like her dad and grandfather before her, but faced tough choices put on women when she had her son 14 years ago. She recently started the U.S. Forest Service's Women in Wildland Fire Advisory Council, taking lessons she's learned to try and help other women. There are now 22 women in different fire jobs across the country on the council. They're looking at things like daycare at Forest Service facilities or changing pregnancy and postpartum fitness requirements, and solutions for all women, like mental health resources and building women-only training camps.
That made my heart so happy, you know, that we had this group and now we could all work on this together to make this systematic change for our agency.
The new council's work comes as the Forest Service is having a hard time recruiting and retaining firefighters. At the beginning of this season, a quarter of fire jobs were still vacant. The agency's new head of fire and aviation says the new council's work is a priority, but it doesn't have dedicated funding at this point, and it's not clear if it will. The Forest Service is anticipating large budget cuts next year. Still, new mom Sarah King is hopeful it will help her stay in her chosen profession.
This is amazing. I have wanted something like this to come to fruition for a long time. So it's like so validating, like being with these women and like just hearing their stories.
The women will meet in person for the first time this winter. For NPR News, I'm Ellis Julin in Missoula.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Misinformation can divide communities, and it can make it harder for people to make informed choices at the ballot box, but also at the grocery store, at the doctor's office. People trust information more when it comes from sources or cultural contexts that they already know. So that means talking to your loved ones can make a difference in the fight against misinformation. For NPR's Life Kit, Audrey Nguyen reports.
It can be difficult to talk to a friend or family member about false or misleading information they're sharing. To increase your chances of having a productive conversation, experts say to start from a place of connection, not correction.
Building these bridges of understanding, I think, also helps people learn and grow on either side of the conversation.
Rachel Kuo is the research facilitator of the Asian American Disinformation Table. She says it's important to set aside the idea of intervention to start. Kuo recommends doing this by taking time to understand why your loved one believes the misleading content. She also says it's important to recognize that your friend or family member has a whole life's worth of experiences that affects how they engage with information.
So often, people's memories really shape the ways that they engage in current ways with political systems and their media environments.
These conversations are not about trying to change someone's core beliefs, says Sarah Nguyen. She's a doctoral candidate at the University of Washington Information School and studies how people share information with each other.
It is more about how can we build this coexisting trust with each other and continue these types of conversations in a sustainable and healthy way.
The goal here is to keep the conversation going. Making someone feel like their worldview is totally wrong is just going to cause them to shut down. So instead of trying to convince your uncle or your auntie to not vote for a particular candidate, try discussing a specific piece of misleading or false information that they're repeating. You might think that keeping that correction short and sweet is the move, but actually,
providing a good amount of detail for why something is wrong is more effective.
That's Professor Bryony Swire-Thompson. She's the director of the Psychology of Misinformation Lab at Northeastern University. She says when you do attempt to correct misleading information, provide a detailed fact check.
So that's one of the best methods that we know to correct misinformation is by not just saying this piece of misinformation is false, but providing what we call a factual alternative. So saying what is actually true.
So say, for example, your friend doubts the integrity of mail-in voting. After you've taken time to understand why they believe that to be true, you can tell them instances of voter fraud are extremely rare. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, a nonpartisan law and policy institute, multiple analyses have shown it's more likely someone will be struck by lightning than commit mail ballot fraud. If things are getting unproductive or you're getting stonewalled, Kuo says it's all right to take a step back.
Reorienting to say, like, okay, like what I care about first and foremost is this relationship. And where do we then move forward together from there, I think helps.
All three experts say you can't expect things to change after one conversation.
There is always this sense of urgency when we hear something false and saying, false, I want to correct you. But in like the spirit of building long-term relationships, to be able to do this on a slower scale will have a larger impact.
These conversations aren't easy, but the hard work can be worthwhile. Audrey Nguyen, NPR News.
For more on Life Kit, go to npr.org/lifekit. This is NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Saturday afternoon. Today on 105 Live, we've got a live session at the Bottleneck in Lawrence. With musical connections to Salina, Lindsborg, and Lawrence, the Draper Family Band features three generations of musicians and the father-son duo of KS Music Hall of Fame's Paul Draper and Brandon Draper. Join Nick Carswell for an in-studio conversation and live tracks. That's on 105 Live today at 5. And if you're listening over on KPR2, it'll be the BBC World Service. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, showers likely, 80% chance of rain, a low of 58 degrees. Showers likely for Sunday, a 90% chance of showers. A high of 68 degrees, 80% chance of showers Sunday night. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. New York City Mayor Eric Adams issued a drought watch today, urging conservation after much of the nation experienced an unusually dry October. The city uses an average of 1.1 billion gallons of water a day. Time ends across the nation at 2 a.m. local time. Clocks go back 1 hour to standard time and move ahead an hour on March 9th of next year. Arizona and Hawaii never change their clocks and remain standard time year-round. A beach park in Maui is closed after a shark bit a surfer and severed his leg. Officials say the 61-year-old man's right leg was completely severed below the knee. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, we are going to hear from a group of people who are not allowed to vote but will be directly affected by the election's results. Uncuffed is a prison radio training program and a podcast where people in California prisons tell their stories. Host Ah Tran visited San Quentin Rehabilitation Center to talk about voting rights, the presidential candidates, and one big ballot measure in California. Tran himself is formerly incarcerated, and you'll hear him talking to currently incarcerated producers Ryan Pagan, Anthony Gomez, and William Harris.
I remember the first time I voted when I got out, and the thing that I did not expect to receive was an I voted sticker. And what I did not expect is how freaking proud I was to have this I voted sticker stamped on my phone. I put that thing on my phone. I want everybody to know I'm a voting citizen, right? I cares about my community, right? I wasn't as excited about this election, this presidential election, but it's very real and it's very relevant. So I want to ask y'all about this current presidential election real quick. Is that cool? Go ahead.
You mentioned the general election. I just am not really excited about either candidates. It's sad that it seems like every 4 years, we're, you know, the American people, we're constantly voting on the lesser of two evils.
Mm. Ryan, talking about the lesser of two evils, right now we got Harris, who is the prosecutor candidate, versus Trump, the felon candidate, right? And it's like, all right, so you want me to vote between this person who incarcerated thousands of people in California, right? Like, this is the harmful legacy she has left behind. And our other option is Trump, the felon, as they're calling him, right? And as much as I have disdain for the fella, you know what I mean? It's harder for me to say felon than it is for me to say Trump. Aunt, tell us more. How does that land with you hearing about this?
Oh, man. So, funny story, right? I remember not so long ago, I'm having a conversation with a good friend of mine, and probably not the best idea to talk politics, right? But she goes on and is like, you know, Trump's he's a felon and he's this and he's that, you know what I mean? And that's why I'm going to vote for Kamala and this, this, that, and the other. And she has some valid points, but when she said that word felon, it like stung me and I almost wanted to tell her, like, I mean, I'm a felon. You know what I mean? Like, what do you think of me? You know? And, but I know she doesn't think of me like in any negative way. And I know she thinks highly of me, but I don't know why I took it personal. Like it hurt. I'm like, damn, he said he's a felon. Like that's, but that's not even who like I would like have favor for. You know what I mean?
Right. Like I'll name this. There's plenty of other reasons to dislike Trump than just the fact that he recently got charged with a crime. People disliked him long before that, right? So I feel like we should focus on the issues like Ryan is saying, like Ant is saying, versus the inflammatory language. Will, how you feel about that?
Well,
yes, I hear what you guys are saying. I do. But if I were a politician, I'd be doing exactly what they're doing. Because the bottom line is, the reason why these politicians mix the issues up and don't actually address them is because the people do not vote for them on issues. They just don't. They vote on personality. You got this buffoon. Donald Trump is a buffoon. And that's just Will Harris's opinion. Donald Trump is a buffoon. He's a moron. People are eating dogs and all that stupid things he was saying. No, that's ridiculous. However, people love that. They love the bravado, the entertainment of it all. And they vote on that. Because if they were actually voting on issues, they wouldn't vote for either one of these two. Because none of them have said anything about what they're actually going to do.
Thank you for, I really appreciate how.
Very passionate.
Yeah.
That's passion.
That's passion.
Yeah. I see what? There's a lot of sweat beating down your forehead. Too. My veins.
Yeah. Yeah. So real quick, I really appreciate how you grounded that and I welcome that perspective. So we're talking about, you know, this presidential election. We're kind of zoomed out a little bit, you know, and from the top end, I said, man, this is not where really I'm passionate about. I care more about down ballot things. So I want to zoom in and talk about some of the issues that we in California are looking at. Who wants to talk a little bit more about Proposition 6? Tell me about Proposition
6. Yeah, let me get into that because I've got notes to make sure I get this totally right. So hang with me here. If you vote yes on this proposition, you're telling the state to amend its constitution and ban involuntary servitude. The California legislature voted on a similar proposal a couple years ago, and they did not pass it. Part of the reason for that was the bill would have required the state to pay us incarcerated workers minimum wage. Politicians like the governor were concerned about the cost. It would have been something like $1.5 billion a year. So they took out the part about the pay and are now just asking voters to decide if the language of involuntary servitude should be removed from the Constitution. If voters say yes, then we won't be forced to work. We will have to give our consent and we won't be punished if we say no. Will, what do you think about that?
I've been discriminated against a lot in my lifetime growing up where I, you know, because I've been in neighborhoods where I was the only black kid. I've been in neighborhoods where I was the only person of color there. And so when you talk about indentured servitude and when you talk about slavery, my perspective is, working is a fact of life. Everybody who wants to take care of himself has a job. So I don't mind having a job. I don't mind working. I don't even mind the pay, so to speak. I mean, I do, but I don't have to pay for food. I don't have to pay for clothing. I don't have to pay for my where to sleep. But being discriminated against is being treated inhumanely. Is what means something to me. And you said that the legislature isn't willing to legislate that, hey, we have to treat human beings like humans. I did not give up my right to be human because I committed a crime. Nobody gives that up. So now that I'm a slave, basically, because that's what I am right now. I am a slave. Because once that's in the Constitution, that's how they can treat me. That language is not just symbolic to me. It means something to me. I am a human being, and all I'm asking for is to treat me humanely. That is it.
Absolutely. And I want to get your thoughts real quick before I close out this piece of it.
Well, I just think one thing to consider is, you know, the public, they have this misconception about people deserving punishment after they've committed a crime. They probably have this like old fashioned mindset, like we deserve to be in prison and breaking rocks with sledgehammers, you know, and they think that that's fair. I think what people forget is that prison itself is the punishment. Like, we are ostracized from society. You know, we're removed from our loved ones. We're removed from the communities that we harmed, you know. And there's a lot of mental, emotional, physical struggles that comes with that that we have to endure.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah, I think, man, like, y'all said it beautifully. Like, yeah, I feel really moved in this moment. There's a heavy feeling in the room when we're talking about this subject, because this is something that we had to live through. And just in this room alone, there's over 100 years of incarceration. If people aren't coming back to prison, that means we are increasing our public safety. But if we continue to call people slaves and treat them as slaves while they're incarcerated and dehumanize them, how can we bring back home healed neighbors into our community? So that's what I truly feel this proposition is about. What type of neighbor do you want coming home to you? The person who was treated like a slave for 2 decades, or a person that was given the resources they need to make sure they never hurt another human being again?
I'm very proud of all of you guys. I'm kind of sitting back and hearing, you know, Will and Anthony and Yutan talk, and I'm like, these guys are incarcerated? Or, you know, Todd, for your case, you were formerly incarcerated. Dude, we sound smart.
Or you can hear more of the Uncuffed podcast wherever you get your podcasts. On Tuesday, hundreds of millions of Americans will cast ballots and decide the future of the country. People are anxious about the results, anxious about the process, doom-scrolling as they wait. So, it takes a lot to make us do. It really seems like a perfect time to take a little bit of a mental break and revisit the absurdist existential art film of sorts that took the internet by storm 10 years ago this week. That's right, we are talking Too Many Cooks, an 11-minute long tour de force that first aired on Adult Swim at 4 a.m. and made its way online, where it has since racked up 26 million views. How can we even begin to describe Too Many Cooks?
It is a joke of a sitcom intro with people looking and smiling at the camera, and then the joke is it doesn't stop.
That's Casper Kelly, who wrote and directed it.
Starts off sort of normal sitcom, and the music gets constructed in a way that you feel like it's about to wrap up. Too many cooks. Then it continues again with more family members, and then does this for a few times.
And doing our best to describe Too Many Cooks on the radio, it just gets weirder and weirder.
You got to start zigging and zagging. So it starts changing genres into a murder show, or a Falcon Crest type soap opera, or even an animated G.I. Joe type show. And then we shift to a sci-fi environment.
This is the story of cooks.
It was all done digitally, although it was made to look like 70s practical effects with like a spaceship on strings. So it's kind of funny to do that digitally. Never have too many cooks. And then it goes off the rails even from that.
Eventually becoming a meta slasher film of sorts.
Our heroine is frozen because they do these freeze frames, and she's able to break out of that, and she runs off the set, and the killer starts chasing her, but her credits are sort of attached to her, floating in front of her, so he's got this sort of beacon of light to follow as he's chasing her down.
That is actually horrifying when she's hiding in the closet and he sees it through the credits. Like, that is actually a truly scary moment.
Yes, I'm so proud of that. I'm so glad you said that.
Casper says the idea for this was all greenlit without him even having to pitch it.
I had told it to some friends, and during an awkward pause at a work party, one of those friends, he said, Casper has this idea, to our boss. So I wasn't even there when it was sold in the room.
And the filming process took 2 to 3 days.
Very run and gun. We used extras because most people didn't have lines. Like I had a friend, Shane Morton, who just had a bunch of monster costumes because he does special effects makeup and stuff. And I'm like, just bring it all. Just throw it all in a truck and bring it over here, you know. So we'll just try stuff, you know.
So this airs at 4 a.m. initially, and I feel like that's a big part of the story about this. But then it hits the internet, and it becomes, I feel like it was all anybody talked about for a few weeks in 2014. When did you first realize that this had taken off and become the 2014 version of viral?
Okay, my Twitter started blowing up, and like people I idolize, like Ryan Johnson and John Hamm, start tweeting about it. And then Rihanna, so that really made my brain explode.
What do you think it was that dug in on people? I mean, other than the music that's still in my head 10 years later.
I do think the music was a big part, and hats off to the composers for that. We worked really hard on that. That's sort of the heroin high I keep chasing of what was the secret formula and how do I do it again? But I think it was just, we had a year to just kind of play around with it and show it to people and tweak it. So I think the timing of the jokes and the changes just hit just right, I think. But I really don't know. I'm looking for someone else to tell me.
I feel like I've seen lots of deep thoughts on what this meant. Like Too Many Cooks really captured the political chaos of the coming decade or the coming fracturing of the media landscape. Have you ever encountered hot, big academic takes on it like that? And what do you think?
Yeah, I enjoy that stuff. And I've read some that I really agree with. And I sort of wrote it intuitively, because your intuition is smarter than your conscious mind. So it's saying things that you're not even aware of. Like, I'm a believer that a lot of writers aren't fully aware of what their work is about.
Mm-hmm.
So it flattered me and made me happy to see these interesting analyses of it.
Does 10 years later you think that there was something there that real time you didn't quite realize?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a lot of things in there that are in my subconscious that came out. Yes.
Can you give us one example?
Well, I did this podcast, and they said there was a theme in all my work of being trapped. And that really haunted me, because there is an element of being trapped. Like, you're trapped in this loop, and you're trying to break out and trying to upset this system.
I can see that.
But I think also there's some element of the killer doesn't belong and wants to belong and wants to destroy it, wants to upset it, wants to break the system. And the system keeps trying to reset itself to return to some sort of normalcy, and he keeps trying to break it.
I think we've had a lot of things in the world that have given us reason to think about yes. those big themes ever since.
Yes. And breaking norms, yes. I think there is. Yeah.
Casper Callie, thank you for helping me kill time in my pre-election anxiousness by talking about Too Many Cooks.
Scott, thank you as well. You saved me from refreshing websites, and I appreciate it.
Anytime. This is All Things Considered for this Saturday. Thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At Progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at Carnegie.org.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. K210 CR in Atchison, 89.9. And K258BT in Manhattan, 99.5. And we're always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us here on a Saturday evening. Stay tuned for 105 Live. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Americana Music Academy in Lawrence, teaching, promoting, and supporting the advancement of all forms of music. Lessons and scholarships available for students of all ages. Details at AmericanaMusicAcademy.com. Showers likely tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, 80% chance of rain, a low of 58 degrees. Showers likely for Sunday, a 90% chance of showers, a high of 68 and 80% chance of rain for Sunday night. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
Hello and welcome to 105 Live. This is Nick Carswell with you for the next hour, sharing the best new, original, and noteworthy music from all across Kansas. Thanks for joining me. On 105 Live this week, we're going to hear music stretching from all over Kansas with Freddie Johnson, David Taylor, Baldwin, Billy Eveling, and many more. And our live session this week comes from the stage of the Bottleneck with the Draper Family Band. Brandon Draper joining us in studio for an interview and some live tracks from that gig coming up a little later on. Getting us started this week, based in Lawrence and Kansas City, Kansas, Metaphobia is an alt-rock band bringing lively and dynamic sound to the music scene. From their album The Act of Loving in Return, released this year, this is the opening track, Finding It Hard by Metaphobia on 105 Live.
Easy to
to prove you strong enough to choose a love that I could lose. Never knew till I saw the proof. My heart all black and blue, but here's what I will do. Make it through. I learned to love again. Oh, I'm as honest as I've ever been. When no walls, no edifice, I am laying down my last defense. Call it a weakness. Nothing between us and I am soft enough to bruise, strong enough to choose a love that I can lose. Soft enough to prove, strong enough to choose a love that I could lose. Never knew till I saw the proof. My heart all black and blue, but here's what I will do. Make it through. Soft enough to prove, strong enough to choose a love that I could lose. Never knew till I saw the proof.
just walked in the door. Give me a minute, G. See if I can find. You know I got good things, Lord, on my mind. Kansas City's great. That's why it's in two states. Ain't got no scenic view. We got good barbecue. Loading all my friends. Ooh, you know they like burnt tents. Both sides of the line. Can't find somebody singing the blues. What is a barbecue? Lord, all my friends. Ooh, you know they like burnt tents.
Shuffly blues inspired by Kansas City barbecue. That is Billy Eberling. The track is Burnt Ends, as you might have guessed. Not trying to make you drool here on 105 Live this week, but that is a fun track. Billy Eberling is well known on the scene in Lawrence and Kansas City. A singer-songwriter, he says here, a multi-instrumentalist, and can often be found on many stages, including Knuckleheads, where he's been performing for 20 years this year with a regular gig at Knuckleheads in Kansas City. That track was Burnt Ends. Before that, we heard from Baldwin. This is a new husband and wife duo based out of Kansas City with connections to Lawrence and originally from Baldwin in Douglas County. That is new to me. That is a track called Bruise. It was from an EP project called Rally, a collection of unapologetically hopeful songs crafted during a season of personal adversity. It's got petty-like guitars, soaring call-and-response choruses combined with sugary pop vocals. I really enjoyed that. I kind of appreciate the space they leave at the end of that track as well. The artist's name is Baldwin. They're out of Kansas City and Lawrence, and that track was Bruise. And then kicking off that run of tunes was Melophobia from their current album released in 2024, The Act of Loving in Return. That was Finding It Hard, kicking off 105 Live this week. Okay, we're going to go straight into our live session next with tracks recorded in the Bottleneck. Again, as part of Mixmaster, we've been sharing quite a few songs from multiple sets that we recorded during the Bottleneck as part of the Mixmaster Music Conference back in early September. And this next act was quite a highlight. It's the Draper Family Band, three generations of musicians. And we're going to come back with some live tracks in an interview with band leader and songwriter Brandon Draper. That's coming up next on 105 Live.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for 105 Live here on a Saturday evening. When you think of the most dangerous abolitionist in Kansas history, you probably think of John Brown. Next time on KPR Presents, the most dangerous abolitionist you probably hadn't heard of before. Todd Melfelt and David Schaefer join Kay McIntyre for KPR Presents, 6 o'clock tomorrow evening here on Kansas Public Radio. Showers likely tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, 80% chance of rain and a low of 58 degrees. Showers likely for Sunday as well, 90% chance of showers, a high of 68 and an 80% chance of showers and storms for Sunday night with a low of 59. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
on 105 Live. That is the Draper Family Band, recorded live in the Bottleneck earlier in September as part of the Mix Master Conference. And we have Brandon Draper in the studio. Welcome, Brandon.
Thanks, Nick.
Thanks for that great performance as well. We're going to hear some more tracks from the Bottleneck, some album tracks from Draper Family Band. But yeah, I'm glad you're here. Let's see. We have a lot we could talk about. I obviously want to focus on Draper Family Band, a 10-piece blues, funk, alternative force of nature, boasting screaming Hammond B3 organs, horn sections, percussions, a lot of what we just heard on that track, and then lots of vocal harmonies as well. So, yeah, let's just start there. I want to touch on some of the other things you do, but Draper Family Band, I guess introducing the family members is going to involve a little bit of the storytelling around what the Draper Family Band is. So tell us who is involved.
So the... where do I begin? It's my dad on Hammond B3. On the record, he plays Wurlitzer and piano, Fender Rhodes, and primarily Hammond organ. And I play guitar, but I also play drums and bass and percussion and vocals. So on the record, there's like 17 different musicians, but when we play live, I hire a drummer and a bass player to play the parts that I played. But it's my dad. So as a little kid growing up, I started playing drums. I started jamming with him. It was encouraged. We would just jam. He had a pretty incredible level of patience to play with a rambunctious little, you know, devil on the drums. I can only imagine, you know. Years down the road, we'd played some different gigs. I made a record for him that was all his music in 2012. And then right after that, we started working on this, and it just never got done. We just kept writing songs, and we would play, and then things just lined up in the past couple of years to put the music together. There's literally 40 to 50 original songs to record. Wow. We got, I think, I don't know, 12 or however many are on this record. Mm-hmm. We're going in the studio Friday. I'm going back to his studio to track a couple things to get out in the next few months. But it's my dad and I are the core. My daughters sing backing vocals. My wife sings backing vocals on a few things. And actually, Taryn played drums when we did a TV promotional thing for the Mixmaster.
For the show, yeah.
Wow. And then all the people that play in the band are deeply connected to the family, you know, if not by blood, just through thousands of hours of being on stage together.
Yeah, you're kind of, I don't want to say calling in favors, but you're directing, because these are people you work with in a bunch of different scenarios, which we will get to here. But,
yeah.
So, I mean, what do you think made it come together in this time? You said you started maybe, 10 years ago or more?
Yeah. It really comes down to what do you want to be when you grow up? And then how do you navigate that? Everybody's going to have a different story. For me, it was in second grade, you know, go to school and dress like what you're going to be when you grow up. And I went with a motorcycle jacket, and that was because I was going to ride a motorcycle, which I still do.
Yeah.
Often. A briefcase because I wanted to be a businessman, and I teach music business at KU, and my wife and I have a record label and a music production company. And then I had a pair of drumsticks because I was going to play drums in bands. And I did that. So this is the trajectory of, I played in different bands. I toured and did some different things. I had kids. I quit doing a lot of the touring in 2015. To focus on building music business programs at the University of Kansas. Mm-hmm. And it just naturally was, you know, man, I really like playing with my dad. Did I put playing with my dad on the back burner to pursue my own stuff? Yeah, for sure. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'll own that. That's what I did. I was young. I was trying to do things. So different seasons of life. And in this season, it's so easy, Nick. You can't imagine. Every minute Dad and I are working on stuff in a studio together, it just works. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's stuff on this record that he's like, well, I don't know what I'm going to play. And I said, well, just see what happens. He puts the headphones on. He does one pass. Everybody in the control room is freaking out. And he gets done and he's like, well, I mean, I guess I know the song now. And we're like, no, that was it. Like he's got this raw, organic kind of, you know, the way he plays is just so alive. It's rare. So I don't know, maybe as I got older, I recognize that, uh-huh. But then it's also like, man, there aren't enough minutes for either of us left on this earth to get as much done as we want to. So let's just record as much as we can. In 2014, we did a bunch of live touring. We traveled and we had a 4-piece, and it was the Draper Family Band, but we didn't have any music released.
Okay.
10 years later, after going through COVID, I spent a lot of time in the studio, and it was like, you know, I've got enough stuff already done. We just need to piece this together. And then my friend Oz McGuire is the general manager at Symphonic Distribution's Los Angeles office. They're a streaming company. They deliver your music to Spotify and iTunes and everything else.
Sure.
And he signed our group with a record label deal so I could put out a bunch of different music with different artists. And so that's what happened. That's how it all kind of came together. But I definitely could not have told you that was going to be the plan 20 years ago or even 10 years ago.
And I'm curious, with your daughters now being part of it, what is that? That must add yet another dynamic to it. And, you know, are you kind of seeing maybe what you were like when you were younger and seeing them come through that?
Yeah.
You're watching them. And I mean, it feeds into it. It makes it special, of course. But they're getting that experience now in the same way that you did.
Yeah. And Dad and I, of course. And Dad and I kind of, we both believe it's like, well, every generation has a chance to, you know, be a little better, go a little further.
Hmm.
I'm involving my daughters, especially Eva, my oldest daughter, in every aspect of the creation. She made the art for the album. It's a picture of a mountain that is like a sound wave. And then she's got song titles hidden within the texture.
Oh, wow.
And it's brilliant. It's, you know, and when she first made it, it was brilliant. Then she put it on a green backdrop, and I was not a fan. And then it grew on me, and now I can't. I mean, she was right. She was right all along. Mm-hmm. And so I'm, even though I didn't see it at first, I'm allowing her to be in a really equal place of ownership. I'm not telling her what to do. And we've got a song right now that we've been working on, and we're still not happy with where we're at with a few of the areas in the lyrics. But we just keep showing up, and we just keep working on it, and we get along. And we do. We get along. We get stuff done.
Yeah.
And when something doesn't work, or it's like, yeah, this just isn't working, okay, let's move on to the next thing. We'll just keep coming back to it and shuffle and...
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's awesome. So, and it's really and truly living up to the name, the Family Band, 3 generations now.
Yeah.
I want to go into a song, and maybe you would introduce this. This is Fall on Your Sword. I'm going to go to the album version this time before we go back to the bottleneck stage. You want to tell us a little bit, introduce this song?
Sure. Yeah. Fall on Your Sword is, that song was written as it was played.
As one of those. Okay.
So I was in my living room. Eva was taking a nap. I was thinking about this idea of Saul from the Bible falling on his sword because he wasn't going to win the war. And it's, you know, this idea of sometimes how people give up, and the idea that these were things that were already spinning in my head, and then it just came out in the song. But the words, would you follow your heart if you know you got left? And that's the idea of like, well, do I really follow my heart and go do this thing that I really believe in, even if I lose all the support that I think is keeping me here? And I think maybe that's my small town upbringing, that it's really scary to leave because you got everything you need right here. But are you going to not follow your heart if you just stay there? And then fall on your sword if you can't have it all. Am I really just going to give up if I can't get all the way over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I, that day, my iPhone was recording, and then I went in the studio 20 times probably to record it, and it never worked. And then I thought, I'm going to take the original iPhone recording. I'm going to load it into Pro Tools. I'm going to double my voice, double the guitar, add a banjo, add some piano. Miles Bonney, the great producer, DJ, singer, one of the early KJHK DJs in Lawrence, Kansas. He lives in Taos. He put some trumpet parts on it, and it was a trust thing. I gave him the tracks and said, hey, could you come up with something on this? And he sent it back, and it was like, that's brilliant. That's it. So this is Fall on Your Sword. Self-titled debut album from the Draper Family Band, that is Fall on Your Sword. That is the studio version. We're going to go back to the Bottleneck with some live tracks here shortly, but Brandon Draper is in the studio with me. Thanks again for being here. You bet, Nick. Thanks for having me.
So you already mentioned quite a bit about the different collaborators you have, both in the record and performing these songs live, but collaboration has been kind of a huge part of your musical life. I'm curious how you find collaborators. What does that look like? Why is it important, I guess, to have those different directions, to bring folks along with you? You mentioned like sharing a track. Can you add something to this?
Yeah.
Which is so cool that people can do that remotely now with people with their own studios. It's kind of adds a whole other dimension to collaboration.
Yeah.
Right? But,
yeah.
But it's collaboration is something you've been inbred to your practice from day one, it sounds like.
Yeah, being a drummer where you've got to play multiple things at once, I think it is a little more natural.
Hmm.
There's a lot of thought around the minds of keyboard players versus the minds of guitar players and the minds of, you know, but as far as drumming, that led me to then play guitar, bass, piano, violin, banjo, didgeridoo. You know, I was always trying to learn different instruments. Seeing Dad play in bands, I just wanted to experience the different things. But I guess to speak directly to benefits of collaboration, the trust part is hard because depending on certain results, you can have your feelings hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, the music doesn't care. The music matters the most, and it's me that is caring either joyfully or or not so happy. Uh-huh. So that part is always interesting because I've had a few things where it's like, man, it's going to be great. I'm going to work with this person. And then I go work with them and it's a dud. Uh-huh. Or it just doesn't vibe. Or,
yeah.
You know,
expectations and yeah. communication are a big part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. This, and for this thing, it just became a dad and I are so interested in finding the best in others. You know, one thing you will hear anybody that's ever played with Paul Draper is he makes everybody sound better, you know, and that's kind of the goal of any drummer is like, I'm going to make the band sound better. This isn't about me. So for that, like there's a paradigm of, okay, I write all these songs by myself. I can record all the parts all by myself and I'm all by myself. I'm not collaborating with anybody. And then I can develop a really big fear of sharing it with anyone
mm-hmm.
because it's become so personal. Here's an example. The first song on the record, Rick Willoughby's on bass, Ernest James, accordion, Marcus Lewis, trombone, Nate Nall, trumpet, Rich Wheeler, saxophone, Eddie Moore, Fender Rhodes, Eva Draper, Ivy Draper, Taryn Draper, backing vocals, Paul Draper, Hammond B3 and piano, myself, guitar, drums, percussion, vocals. You know, there's that song was recorded by me. I did a lot of the stuff in my studio first. Then I took it to Dad's studio to get some of the keys. Mark Thies at Marcosa Studio. We did a few things, Weights and Measures with Dwayne Trower, and then at Tone Dimension with Brian Nicholas. I mean, there's our publicist, Emily Ginsberg from Big Hassle Media, promotion and management. I had a couple students, previous students of my music business programs helping with publicity. And it's like, really what happened was once I learned how to trust that this is good,
mm-hmm.
I believe in this. I'm not embarrassed to play this for you. The Brandon that was 20 years old was really embarrassed to play it for you. If I could go back in time, I would just blow that kid up with positive motivation and encouragement that, no, send it to some labels,
mm-hmm.
you know. So,
yeah,
I think that's where it's like, why'd we end up with accordion? Well, Jamie was hanging out in the studio. He just came by to see what we were doing. You know, see the process, and we're like, man, this song could use accordion. Do you have it? And do you have one of your accordions in the car? And he's like, yeah, I'll grab it real quick.
Yeah.
And it just made that tune pop. So, yeah, takes a village.
Right.
Well, you know?
And it comes naturally to you because of your experience, just as you described. But no, I appreciate that. That was a...
And hyperactivity. Like, I don't sit still. So I'm spinning 10 plates at once, and
yeah.
I want to talk to you about what gets you excited, and I want to find out where does that intersect with...
Yeah.
If it doesn't intersect with me, then maybe, hey, you should meet this person. They've got a similar, you know, connecting the dots.
And it's also important to... I think where you started all that was with the song, and that's the, you know, the end product is what we see is the song, and that then has its own life, you know, rooted in all of this collaboration that you just mentioned. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed that little
yeah.
ride. You took us on there all around one song, Aim All Around, which is the
yeah.
album opener, right?
So, yeah.
Okay, and we're going to hear one more song for today, which is That Cat from the Stage of the Bottleneck. Anything you want to share about this song?
This is fun. I wrote this when I was 17 years old.
wow.
So... Yeah, Brandon of that era didn't have the confidence to record it and share it with anybody. You know, I was shy.
Yeah.
And I'm not a shy person, but when it was like sharing this thing I wrote.
Yeah.
So I was driving home and there was this cat in the middle of the road, and it's the country. There's no houses anywhere. And I brought it home and then was just singing about it, you know, that cat transforms in the daylight. Like, I just made up this story, and I said he's been messing around Mungo's house, which is a reference to Mungo, the character from Heathcliff,
mm-hmm.
the old cartoon from the 80s.
Sure.
And it's just got a cool vibe, and it's got a section that everybody solos, and we move up minor thirds until we get back to center again, and... So I like telling people about this song that it's like, you know what? It was good when I wrote it and it remained good, and everything that people create, especially when it's intellectual property like music. When you write a song, you've basically just planted that seed and it can't die. It's like you gave birth to this thing and it can stay there forever. And there's so many countless stories of famous people that heard their song on the radio and forgot they wrote it. You know, Dolly Parton has a bunch of stories like that, or Willie Nelson, you know, they just are incredible, brilliant songwriters. And, you know, I guess my point is to value the creation, really put a strong value on the things you create. And it matters to you. It doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. And if you get to a place where you can share it and people like it, keep sharing it with those people.
Love it.
Find your audience. Yeah.
Well, I like that you get a chance to do that in various aspects of your life. And in this case, it's your own music. And back to 17-year-old Brandon is getting the chance to come full circle. All right. Well, we're going to leave you with that. Thanks for joining us here in the studios. And thanks for this great set at the Bottleneck. And we're hoping to get to share more tracks from that set over the course of 105 Live. But thank you for being here, Brandon.
You bet. Thanks, Nick.
And live from the stage of the Bottleneck, this is the Draper Family Band with That Cat on 105 Live.
That cat transforms in the daylight. That cat seems to do everything.
From a live session recorded in the Bottleneck back in early September, that is the Draper Family Band. That tune was That Cat. Thanks to Brandon for joining me in the studio and the band for playing that set. And thanks to Jason Sloat for mixing and producing the live session. Okay, still more music to come on 105 Live. We're going to hear tracks from David Taylor as well as Freddie Johnson and some news about an exciting music series that was recorded at the Topeka State House featuring Freddie and multiple Kansas artists. More info on that and more Kansas music coming right up on 105 Live.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for 105 Live here on a Saturday evening. Tonight on KPR's Live at Green Lady Lounge, it's the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. They're a late-night favorite at the Green Lady, and they'll be performing an hour of all-original tunes. Join us for Live at Green Lady Lounge with the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. That's tonight at 6 here on Kansas Public Radio. Showers likely tonight in northeast and east central Kansas. 80% chance of showers and a low of 58 degrees. Showers likely for Sunday. A 90% chance of showers for tomorrow morning and afternoon. A high of 68 and 80% chance of showers Sunday night. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
Gonna go out for a little drive just to ease my mind. This last week slipped away like a cold woman say. I just wanna see your face. And I know, and I know, and I know it'll never stop wasting time wasting away. Save this tragedy for another day. I only wish you'd call me. My cocoon, there's plenty of room. My arms remain open for you. I mean no harm, that's the truth. I just need some
originally from Kinsley, Kansas, with a long career in music. That is Freddie Johnson. He was a live guest on 105 Live a couple of weeks back. That track was Darlin', which also featured Amy Mann on that recording. That's from his Back on the Road to You album. That was Freddie Johnson. Freddie also features on an exciting new program that's coming up on public television in Topeka with KTWU. The LG Desk Concerts are a new concert series featuring incredible Kansas performing arts talent, recorded live from the office of the Lieutenant Governor of Kansas. Performances include Freddie Johnson, the Opus 76 Quartet, Maria the Mexican, Sun Venezuela, Bad Alaskan, and Kelly Hunt, with a bonus performance coming soon. They were hosted by Sierra Scott, who's the host for PBS Kansas's Positively Kansas program. So these were recorded live in the State House in Lieutenant Governor David Tolan's office, and I was able to attend one of the tapings, and it's a pretty cool setup. LG Desk, I guess kind of Kansas's answer to a tiny desk, with LG Lieutenant Governor maybe meaning large as well. I'm not sure how deep the concept goes. These programs will be available Friday evening, 7:30 p.m. starting on Friday, November 8th on KTWU, that's PBS in Topeka. And we're also going to share them here on 105 Live. They're going to be our live sessions for several weeks starting at the end of this month. I'm very excited to share those. It's a cool project highlighting Kansas artists, which is what we like to do here on 105 Live. Before that track from Freddie Johnson, we heard The Swallowtails with Cocoon. The Swallowtails is also going to be featured on an upcoming 105 Live. They're the final act that we had performing in the Bottleneck earlier in September as part of Mixmaster. So one more live set from that show. The Swallowtails are based out of Kansas City, Kansas, are a duo with acoustic guitar and bassoon, not a combo you see too often. But I love those songs and the pairing of the voices as well as the instrumentation and arrangements. So stay tuned for more live tracks from The Swallowtails coming up on future editions of the show. Okay, we've got time for one more song. David Taylor is based out of Lawrence, Kansas, is a former MCA recording artist, has worked in the music industry a lot, including producing online videos for a lot of other artists. And this track is a single, little taste of a politically tinged song here from David Taylor. The track is called My Country. With the election coming up next week, I do encourage you to go and vote if you haven't done so. And otherwise, keep tuning into KPR and 105 Live. My name is Nick Carswell. Thanks for joining me.
When I look around, I see my country going down. You know, I really hate the sound of this. Liar, liar, on the loose, just stick your head into the news. Will you make a big excuse for this?
Support for 105 Live on KPR comes from the Burt Nash Center, reminding listeners that it's okay to not be okay. Information about taking the first steps to address stress, anxiety, and depression is at 785-843-9192 or burtnash.org. And Cromwell Solar, since 1982, installing independent energy systems such as backup batteries and solar panels for farms, homes, and businesses. More information is at cromwellsolar.com. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU in KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH in KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV in KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. Online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Welcome to the Green Lady Lounge, located at 1809 Grand Boulevard in Kansas City. I'm Daryl Brighton. The Green Lady has live jazz 365 days a year. And if you happen to drop in some late night, you're very likely to see the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. You'll often find them there serenading crowds into the wee small hour. If you can't stay up that late, join us now for an hour of original KC jazz by drummer Antonio Reyes, guitarist Taylor Smith, and Andre Reyes Jr. at the Hammond B3. The Reyes Brothers Organ Trio, live at the Green Lady Lounge. Thank you.
stepping out.
Thank you.
Where does it go? Thank you. let's get Mr. Taylor Smith on the guitar. Taylor Smith. Antonio Reyes on the drums. Antonio Reyes. And my name is Andre Reyes Jr. We are the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio here tonight at the Green Lady Lounge. We're going to take a short break, but we are here till 2:30 a.m. tonight. So sit back, relax, and enjoy your night with us. Please don't forget, take care of your bartenders and your servers out there. And if you are enjoying the music, we have a Tim Jar up here as well. We're the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio.
That's the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio with a tight fix composed by guitarist Taylor Smith. I'm Daryl Brogdon, and we're at the Green Lady Lounge, 1809 Grand Boulevard in Kansas City, where there's live jazz every night of the week. Check out the Green Lady's performance calendar and online store at greenladylounge.com. There's more with the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio coming up.
Support for Live at Green Lady Lounge comes from F.W. Houston Medical Senior Living Center, providing senior care in Jefferson County for loved ones close to home. More information on tours and availability at 913-774-4340. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 99.5 Manhattan, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. 80% chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, a low of 58 degrees. Showers likely on Sunday, 90% chance of showers for tomorrow morning and afternoon, 80% chance of rain tomorrow night. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
And we're back at the Green Lady Lounge for more with the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. You can see this band several nights a week at the Green Lady. So let's get back with more music now by drummer Antonio Reyes, guitarist Taylor Smith, and Andre Reyes Jr. at the Hammond B3. The Reyes Brothers Organ Trio, live at the Green Lady Lounge.
Once again, welcome back to the Green Lady Lounge. You're listening to the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio here tonight, featuring Mr. Taylor Smith on the guitar, Antonio Reyes on the drums. My name is Andre Reyes Jr. on the Hammond organ, and once again, we are the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. Thank you.
Thank you.
to you. Let's get Mr. Taylor Smith on the guitar. Taylor Smith. Antonio Reyes on the drums. And my name is Andre Reyes Jr. on the Hammond organ. We are the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. We'll be right back here at the Green Lady Lounge. Please don't forget, take care of your bartenders and your servers out there. And if you are enjoying the music tonight, we have a tip jar up here as well. But once again, we are the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. We'll be right back here at the Green Lady Lounge.
Reyes Brothers Organ Trio with BAM, a tune by Andre Reyes Jr., who's at the Hammond B3 here at the Green Lady Lounge. The other members of the trio include drummer Antonio Reyes and guitarist Taylor Smith. You can buy the trio's latest album online at greenladylounge.com. Today's show was recorded by Ken Lovern and John Scott, post-production by Chuck Smith.
Live at Green Lady Lounge is produced by your host, Daryl Brogdon. Hope you enjoy these weekly sessions with some of Kansas City's finest jazz musicians. You can drop us a note at kansaspublicradio.org. Live at Green Lady Lounge is a co-production of Kansas Public Radio and the Green Lady Lounge.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU in KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH in KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV in KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. And always online at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us here on a Saturday evening. Stay tuned for the Retro Cocktail Hour. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Americana Music Academy in Lawrence, teaching, promoting, and supporting the advancement of all forms of music. Lessons and scholarships available for students of all ages. Details at AmericanaMusicAcademy.com. 80% chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight in northeast and east central Kansas. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.